This morning's reading comes from, there are two readings actually this morning. The first comes from the book of Ezekiel. It is Ezekiel chapter 10, verses 1 to 19. The second reading comes from Zechariah chapter 2 and is verses 1 to 13. And so then, Ezekiel chapter 10, beginning of verse 1. I looked, and I saw the likeness of a throne of lapis lazuli above the vault that was over the heads of the cherubim. The Lord said to the man in the cloud, clothed in linen, go among the wheels beneath the cherubim. Fill your hands with burning coals from among the cherubim and scatter them over the city. And as I watched, he went in. Now the cherubim were standing on the south side of the temple, and the man went in, and the cloud filled the inner court. Then the glory of the Lord rose from above the cherubim and moved to the threshold of the temple. The cloud filled the temple, and the court was full of the radiance of the glory of the Lord. The sound of the wings of the cherubim could be heard as far away as the outer court, like the voice of God Almighty when he speaks. When the Lord commanded the man in linen, take fire from among the wheels, from among the cherubim, the man went and stood beside a wheel. Then one of the cherubim reached out his hand to the fire that was among them. And he took up some of it and put it in the hands of the man in linen, who took it and went out. Under the wings of the cherubim could be seen what looked like human hands. I looked and I saw beside the cherubim four wheels, one beside each cherubim, and the wheels sparkled like topaz. As for their appearance, four of them looked alike. Each was like a wheel intersecting a wheel. As they moved, they would go in any one of four directions. The cherubim faced the wheels and did not turn about as the cherubim went. The cherubim went in whatever direction the head faced without turning as they went. Their entire bodies, including their back, the backs of their hands, and their wings were completely full of eyes, as were their four wheels. I heard the wheels being called whirling wheels. Each of the cherubim had four faces. One face was that of a cherub, the second face that of a human being, the third face the face of a lion, and the fourth face a face of an eagle. Then the cherubim rose up. These were living creatures that I had seen by the Kibar. When the cherubim moved, the wheels beside them moved, and the cherubim spread their wings to rise from the ground, and the wheels did not leave their side. When the cherubim moved, the wheels beside them moved, and then the cherubim spread their wings from the ground, and the wheels did not leave their side. When the cherubim stood, they also stood. And when the cherubim rose, they rose because of them, because of the spirit of the living creatures within them. Then the glory of the Lord departed from over the threshold of the temple and stopped above the cherubim. While I watched, the cherubim spread their wings and rose from the ground, and they went, wheels within them. They stopped at the entrance of the east gate and the Lord's house, and the glory of the Lord of Israel was above them. Our second reading is from Zechariah chapter 2 and is verses 1 to 13. Then I looked up, and there before me was a man with a measuring line in his hand. I asked, what are you doing? And he answered me, to measure Jerusalem, to find out how wide and how long it is. When the angel who was speaking to me was leaving, another angel came in to meet him, and he said, run and tell the man, Jerusalem will be like a city without walls because of the great number of people and animals in it. And I myself will be a wall of fire around it, declares the Lord, and I will be its glory within. Come, come, flee from the land of the north, declares the Lord. I have scattered you to the four winds of heaven, declares the Lord. Come, Zion, escape you who live in the daughter Babylon. For this is what the Lord Almighty says. After the glorious one has sent me, the nations that have plundered you, for whoever touches you touches the apple of his eye. I will surely raise my hand against you, so the slaves will plunder them. Then you will know the Lord Almighty has sent you. Shout, be glad, daughter of Zion, for I am coming and I will live among you, declares the Lord. Many nations will be joined with the Lord in that day and will become my people. I will live among them, and you will know that the Lord Almighty has sent me. The Lord will inherit Jerusalem as his portion in his holy land, and I will again choose Jerusalem. Be still before the Lord, all mankind, because he has roused himself from his holy dwelling. We thank God for his word to us this morning. Then it was gone. It had been a long time coming. And when it did, it was magnificent, filled with color, filled with sound. It was one of those events that you could not possibly forget. It was a sort of event that leaves you awestruck, gaping at what had happened. But in reality, it was tragic. It was the worst of all possible outcomes, rolled up into one. For Ezekiel, the pain was over. The pain of Israel's unfaithfulness. Israel's rejection had finally found the culmination of the found its culmination in the Lord's departing. His glory, his presence had left the temple. And now there was a new sadness, a new emptiness. It is almost as if it's almost like a loss of a loved one who has suffered a long-term illness. You know the end is coming. But when it comes, you seem totally unprepared for it. And while you live in the sadness of the long-term illness, when they finally go, there is a new sadness, an emptiness. And that in that new sadness and that emptiness, it's summed up here in one sentence in Ezekiel 10. Then the glory of the Lord departed from the threshold of the temple and stopped above the cherubim. This, like many passages in Ezekiel, saddens me. It saddens me because it marks the culmination of a host of inappropriate actions. It saddens me because it happens despite all the warnings. And it saddens me because it marks the zenith of the Lord's frustration. It causes me to ask the question, where did it all begin? What were the warning signs? Why did we miss them? Now, of course, part of my role as interim minister is to discover the answers to those questions. But while that is part of the reason you call me to be among you, there's more to life than simply analyzing and the sadness of our mistakes. And certainly in the economy of God, if all there were to life was an opportunity to analyze our mistakes, what a terrible place this would be. But that is not the case, because we are a resurrection people. The people of God, the people who God restores life to, the people who God longs to give hope and a future to. And while I was keen to have the Ezekiel passage read, where the Lord's glory departs from the temple, the reason I wanted to read it was because it sets the backdrop for this passage in Zechariah. Passage in Zechariah 2, which is a stark contrast. Because this is the promise of the Lord's return. Look at verse 10. Shout and be glad, daughter of Zion, for I am coming and I will live among you, declares the Lord. Well, it's true that we must acknowledge the failures of the past. After all, acknowledging them will hopefully help us not to repeat them in the future. It also gives us an opportunity to seek God's forgiveness and his restoration. But it is restoration that is happening here in Zechariah chapter 2. The second chapter of Zechariah opens with a man with a measuring line. This is usually a rope knotted at intervals and used to measure out temporary territory or the height of a wall. In the Old Testament, it's used both to measure an area for destruction, as in Lamentations 2:8, or building and construction, as in 1 Kings 7:23. And here in Zechariah, it's being used to measure the size of Jerusalem. But notice that no sooner had the man with a measure gone to measure the circumference of Jerusalem than Zechariah is sent after him to tell him Jerusalem is going to be a city without walls. The term city without walls intrigues me. It intrigues me because it resonates with the Church Without Walls projects of the 2000s. It intrigues me because a lack of walls suggests that you can enter the city from a variety of different places, directions. Any lane or entry pathway will do. You can enter day or night. Nothing prevents you. And intrigues me because it speaks of a city that is unprotected in the traditional sense. Entering a city without walls is much easier than when you are restricted by going through a specific place, a gateway through a thick wall. And it leaves me wondering, if we leave the official meanings aside, if we leave all the ways the Church Without Walls has been interpreted in different places and in different times, what would it mean for us? What would it mean for us to be a church without walls? A place where it is easy to enter, a place where it is easy to come and encounter God. And how would we make that happen? Notice also, the reason for the city being without walls is not because it's going to take another 70 years for Nehemiah to realize he has to come and rebuild the walls. The city without walls is to be without walls because of the sheer number of people and animals within it. If there was a word of restoration here, it's here in Zechariah 2, because scholars generally believe the number of people who would return to Jerusalem under Zerubbabel and Joshua was quite small. And even though there would be more returns under Ezra and Nehemiah, the numbers would still be small. And yet here in the promise is a promise that the city will become so populous that walls will not contain it. Leaves me wondering what the Lord has for us here. In reality, there are times when congregations become too small. There are in their smallness, because of their smallness, they find it difficult to grow again. They may soldier on for a number of years, but they never regain their former glory. And yet in the economy of God, there are always opportunities for restoration. There is always an opportunity for a church to rise from its ashes. The Old Testament stories of Israel are testimony to this. Time and time again, God raises up his people, rebuilds from a remnant. The fact that the glory can leave in Ezekiel and return in Zechariah is testimony to this. Not only are the stories biblical, there are numerous stories of churches that close, that come close to closing, that become really small, and congregations find something in the economy of God that causes them to grow again. These stories contain hope. Hope that the Lord might do a work among us that sees our numbers grow again. I wonder if that might be something we can hold on to. But there's something else here as well. Because while Jerusalem is to be a city without walls, it's not to be a city without protection. Because the Lord has promised that he himself will be its protection. He will be a surrounding ring of fire. I wonder if this is a flashback to the time when he had led his people through the wilderness as a pillar of fire. A reminder of how they seem to be so vulnerable. As a desperate group of people wandering the desert, dependent on the Lord for food and water and protection. And yet the Lord had never abandoned them. Throughout that experience, he had guided them. Or is this something else? Is this a reminder of how vulnerable city walls are to fire in the ancient Near East? We can see this in Nehemiah 1. If we were to speed forward to Nehemiah, we'd find his friends and his colleagues coming to speak of how the walls in Jerusalem had broken down and the gates had been burned with fire. As high as the city walls were, their most vulnerable points were their gateways. And being made of wood, they were vulnerable to fire. Which leaves me wondering, where are we vulnerable? But it leaves another question for me. In the surrounding ring of fire, the surrounding wall of fire, as a reminder of God's protection, is it a reminder of God's protection? Is it a reminder of the vulnerability? Personally, I think it's both. I think there's something here about the protectiveness of God and the destructiveness of God. Protection that a fire gives late at night when you're sleeping outdoors. Protecting from animals and wild animals who are on the prowl. But also fire has the ability to consume. It said during the 1943 Hamburg firestorm created by the RAF bombing, the temperature in the center of the city was so hot that metal, sheet metal, just ran like water. Stones cracked and crumbled and people were vaporized, consumed by the fire. A ring of fire says something important about the nature of God. His desire to protect, but also his ability to consume. But there's something else here as well. Because fire needs three things to exist. Go on any fire protection, any firefighting force, and they will tell you that the fire needs fuel, heat, and oxygen. Starve it of any one of these three things, and the fire will go out. Which is worrying to me, because if fire is your protection, you're going to need to feed it. Is this a reminder that the people rebuilding the temple, creating a space for God to be in their midst, are going to need to feed their relationship with the Lord? Is it a prompt to them to keep short accounts of their sin, to act justly and to love mercy in their relationships with others? This promise to Israel is a wall of fire and ask important questions. Are we willing to trust in the Lord for our protection as we seek to create a place that signifies God in our midst? But more than that, are we willing to feed our relationship with the Lord, give him the fuel, the oxygen, the heat that a relationship needs? I wonder. But there's something here else here as well. Look at verses 8 and 9. For this reason, this is what the Lord Almighty says. After the glorious one has sent me against the nations that have plundered you, for whoever touches you touches the apple of his eye, I will surely raise my hand against them so that their slaves will plunder them, and that you will know the Lord Almighty has sent me. Last week, we spoke about reparations, about those who had been tasked by the Lord to discipline Israel, had overstepped the mark. And now, following the exile, the Lord was making reparations. But there is also a reminder here of what Israel means to the Lord. Well, actually, what God's people as a whole mean to him. Whoever lays a hand on God's people touches the Lord at a sensitive point. Find that interesting, that God would be particularly sensitive to a particular area. In this case, his relationship with Israel. I think you can read that as his relationship with his people. Touch post-exilic Israel and you poke God in the eye. And just as if you were to poke God into the eye, two things happen at once simultaneously. Poke yourself in the eye, it's painful, and there's a instant blinking reaction. Your eye seeks to protect you. The implication here is touch God's people and two things happen instantaneously. God protects and God reacts. Reasons for this can't simply be Israel's faithfulness. In fact, quite the opposite. Israel has behaved so badly in previous generations that there's no good reason why God would hold them as the apple of his eye. And yet they are. Scholars believe the reason for that is whatever they do doesn't change what God is doing. And what he is working out his purposes through the people of God, through them. Despite all their rebellion, he's inching towards a people who will fulfill a covenant given to Abraham in Genesis 12. A covenant that promised to make Israel a great nation, but not just make Israel a great nation, but make them a blessing to all nations. And that prompts a question. What does the Lord have for us? What blessing will we bring to this part of Cambridge on the edge of the city centre where very few people live in the immediate vicinity and businesses are more focused on making money and keep themselves afloat so they can pay their staff than what the Lord might be doing among them? Surely it has something to do with the tourists who pass by the door. Surely it has something to do with those who sleep in the doorways of businesses just a few yards up the road. But maybe not. Maybe it's something less obvious. However, there is one thing I am sure about, and that is if the process of rebuilding is to take shape in this place, then it will be because God has a purpose for us to bless others. It will be because he has a blessing he wants for us to bestow on the people who pass through this part of Cambridge. And our mission, should we choose to accept it, is to seek out what that blessing would be. This passage in Zechariah comes to a close with a promise of the Lord's coming. But notice, unlike most prophetic books, the promise doesn't come at the end of the book. After all the warnings that the Lord gives, it comes at the very start of Zechariah. The start of something new. This part of Zechariah speaks of the Lord's coming and taking up residence again. It speaks of his protection of his people. And it speaks of bestowing a blessing not simply on Israel, but all sorts of people. Look again at verse 11. Many nations will be joined with the Lord in that day and will become my people. And I will live among you and you will know the Lord Almighty has sent you. Whatever is to come in the next few chapters of Zechariah, it will broaden the scope and reach beyond the people of God. Here, where they are currently so few, they will become numerous. Here, where the walls have fallen down and the gates burned, they will find protection in their God. Here, while other nations have disciplined them, there is the promise of a new land, a new city filled with the people of God from every tribe and tongue. And all of them will know that the Lord is among them. Do you get a sense, a hint of Pentecost here? The time when the disciples rushed into the temple courts, declaring the praises of God in such a way that people from all sorts of different places heard the good news of Jesus in their own language. You have to be of a certain age, of a certain time, but I wonder if you remember the Airfix toy known as Weebles. It used to come with a little advertising ditty, wee balls wobble, but they don't fall down. I used it once as an illustration for Easter Sunday. I spoke of how on Good Friday, Jesus was down, but he was not out. Here in Zechariah 2, we have the people of God who have been down. The Lord, in Ezekiel 10, the Lord had departed his presence from them. But they were not out, because here in Zechariah 2, there is a promise of the Lord's return among them. The people of God may be down, but they're not out in the economy of God. And I wonder, in the economy of God, whether we are a people who are down, but not out. I wonder. Amen.